KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley.
Napa, California.
I live in the Castro Fillmore District.
Bernal Heights.
Coming up, an update on the campfire from a reporter in Chico.
It was as if the apocalypse was descending from the foothills, thick, black clouds just blocking out the entire sun.
Then an in-depth look at a topic we sometimes avoid.
Death is not something we really talked about until it happened, you know, and I guess it's kind of hard to talk about these things.
Well, today we're talking about it and looking at the barriers encountered by Asian Americans and Latinos needing comfort care at the end of life.
What we have to do and our responsibility as providers is talk to the loved one to see what their preference is.
That's coming up. Cross Currents is next. The campfire in Butte County burned down more than 15,000 structures. Evacuation centers are filling up. The town of Paradise suffered a huge portion of the devastation, death, and destruction. To get an update on the situation, I spoke with Mark Albert, a reporter with North State Public Radio in Chico, just 14 miles from Paradise. Can you describe where these fires are and what it looks like right now?
Well, Hannah, I have to tell you, it is a very, the words are almost indescribable. Before we even get to the level of destruction, which is just unimaginable, it's like a war zone. Paradise is a beautiful place, but it looks like a different world. There was a lot of fuel built up, and certainly in the area where the fire initiated, I was up there in the fire zone, and the roads are difficult to navigate under the best of circumstances.
So in terms of the people affected, what we're hearing is that Paradise is predominantly a retirement community. Who are the people there that you've met?
Well, Paradise is an historic Gold Rush community. It is near, very close to the site where the historic Gold Town Nugget, I believe it was 53 or 58 pound gold nugget, was discovered during the Gold Rush. There's a lot of history, and there's a lot of people who are kind of natives and have been there for generations. The location had quite a few logging jobs, and of course mining. Most of that, of course, is gone. Paradise is really an affordable community. There are a lot of people who are primarily living on fixed incomes, many older people. There are quite a few retirees, many senior citizens. The cost of living here is, of course, much lower. And for a place like Paradise, where so many of the people are likely underinsured, and also living on fixed incomes, or have saved up their entire lives to build a small structure, or living in trailers, because there are many humble homes, many manufactured homes, and trailer parks as well. I don't know how those people will bounce back. I think that there will be a profound financial loss, especially among much of Paradise's community.
And, I mean, that's my next question. What does it look like people are planning for, and how do you even start planning? It feels like it's a place where folks thought they would honestly kind of live the rest of their lives in that place. So what's some of the stuff that you're hearing from people who've been evacuated, from volunteers?
Well, you know, I don't know about rebuilding just yet. The electrical lines, there are melted, burnt power lines all over the place. The roads are, some roads impassable, where there were still trees across the road or telephone poles down. I was up there on Saturday. Things were smoldering all over the place. And people initially, at least when I went to the evacuation shelters, as people were just running for their lives on Thursday, people were tremendously grateful to be alive and in shock and being fueled by adrenaline keep their spirits up, and just really walking into things feeling astounded and extremely grateful to be alive. Now, it's been almost a week A lot of that is starting to wane. People are growing impatient to get back to their homes. I would say about 19 out of 20 of the homes in Paradise were completely demolished. There are very few standing structures, and in structures that were damaged, there just isn't anything left. The elementary school, frankly, looks like a scene out of Hiroshima. Aside from the trees, all the stately ponderosa pines, many of which are still standing, the human-built structures are nothing more than piles of ashes. It is really just a sight to behold. And at least from the beginning of this, on Thursday morning, it was as if the apocalypse was descending from the foothills. Thick black clouds just blocking out the entire sun. You could see the seam where the north winds were preventing the smoke from arriving here in Chico. It stayed maybe a couple hundred feet off the valley floor, at least for the first 24 hours or so. And since then, it's like the thickest fog you've seen on Ocean Beach, except that it smells like a campfire.
I mean, our air quality here in the San Francisco Bay Area, you know, my daughters haven't had recess for that for a week. It's really, really thick. It feels like toxic air. And I'm just wondering if it's here like that up there, it must be very, very, very difficult. And with these vulnerable populations specifically in terms of health care, what are you seeing in that regard?
Places that were in the direct path of the smoke, so areas due south of where the fire broke out, have been impacted since the get-go. Places like Oroville, like Yuba City and Marysville, have been taking it on the chin. In Chico and further north, it's been on and off. I know that as the winds died back, the smoke started to retrograde further north, and unfortunately, so much of it went down towards the Bay Area, towards Sacramento as well. You know, in terms of medical aid, people are scrambling. You know, this is a very generous community. People are coming out of the woodwork to help. They're providing medical supplies. People are volunteering medical aid. The FEMA has just arrived in town, and things are starting to get a little bit more organized. I'm also hearing on social media, though I have not confirmed this, that there's some sort of norovirus outbreak somewhere. We're trying to track that down, and that could just be compound things and make things so unfortunately worse. That's the cruise ship virus. I've had it personally several times, and you cannot function, and it lasts about 48 hours, and you need to be in a bathroom for that entire period, almost for that entire period. And if you have hundreds of people trying to share four or five bathroom stalls, or you have some of our places that have turned into evacuation centers are on ancient septic tanks, we've got some real issues up here.
That's Mark Albert, a reporter with North State Public Radio in Chico. Find links to his reporting at KELW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Hannah Ababa. Yesterday, we reported that many African Americans lack access to basic comfort care at the end of life, hospice and palliative services that can ease pain and suffering during the dying process. The obstacles are even greater for Asians, Latinos, and other ethnic minorities. Language barriers and cultural traditions can inhibit awareness of end-of-life options, and they're often compounded by poverty and lack of education. As KELW's Joanne Marr reports, the barriers faced by immigrants of color can have devastating consequences.
Can everybody hear? Okay.
大家聽唔聽得清楚啊?
Terry Daniel is a grief counselor meeting with a group of Chinese seniors at a San Francisco housing community. She's here to learn about their customs and traditions relating to the end of life.
And so we're going to talk about death here, and I hope that's okay with everybody.
The women share stories about visits to cemeteries and setting up altars for their ancestors. They've spent a lot of time and thought honoring their deceased relatives, but not much time making plans for their own deaths.
So I would ask how many of you have told your children or social workers or whoever what you wish for your end of life?
Only 6 people out of 25 raised their hands. The Senior Center has held many workshops on preparing for the end of life and completing advance directives, a legal document that specifies their wishes and preferences for medical treatment. But very few of the residents have followed through, and most have not had conversations with their children.
She said, "My children actually even more fearful than us."
Yes,
and then she started
yes.
laughing.
That is true. That is... Because for the children, they are afraid of the pain of loss.
Studies show that fewer ethnic minorities use hospice services compared to whites. That means they have less access to the comfort care and pain management hospice can provide to help ease the discomfort and suffering that often accompanies dying.
So making sure that we talk with people and prepare people in advance for these serious illnesses, that's what we're trying to promote nationwide.
Dr. Alex Smith is among the many concerned palliative care specialists in the Bay Area seeking to improve care at the end of life.
More importantly, is understanding what the goals and the values are. What type of life is worth living? What kind of trade-offs are they willing to make in order to have that type of life? What are they afraid of? And what kind of quality of life is acceptable to them, right? Those are the kind of conversations that are very important and help family members prepare for that in-the-moment decision-making.
Death is not something we really talked about until it happened, you know, and I guess it's kind of hard to talk about these things.
Luis Hernandez is a graduate student at the University of California at Berkeley. His mother died suddenly of liver cancer a few years ago, just when the semester had started.
She had pains for quite some time. She was very hesitant to go to the doctors. My mom was always very scared of doctors and never wanting to go. No matter how many times me and my brother like told her, go, like, you need to go. It's important to go. Like, she's like, I'm scared they'll find something. I'm like, well, that's the point of doctors.
But she waited too long. By the time she finally saw the doctor, she was diagnosed with stage 4 liver cancer. After emergency surgery, she got sicker and later died in the hospital. Because events moved so quickly, there was no time for Hernandez and his brother to talk with their mother and discuss hospice or alternatives to the aggressive medical interventions she received. That conversation should have taken place long ago.
I mean, you know, we're not rich white people, right? So, like, we're living in the projects of Brooklyn, New York. It's not easy to plan that. And even on the weekends, too, she's working. She's taking care of the house. She's maintaining everything. Like, you know, where do you find time to plan all that out?
Poverty is just one of many potential challenges.
Nearly 24 law enforcement agents surrounded this suburban Texas home early Wednesday morning. Inside, 62 undocumented immigrants.
For those without legal status, Dr. Smith says fear of deportation can lead to delays in seeking medical help or planning for the end of life.
I'm seriously concerned that the overall direction our country has taken, building the border wall, forced separation of families, will have consequences. And in particular, at the end of life, when people are seriously ill and need support from others. Because it takes very little to prevent accessing services, you know, until it's too late, until you're really suffering, until you're dying, until you're hospitalized in the intensive care unit.
Cultural beliefs, values, and religion can also be barriers to good end-of-life care. In many Asian and Latino cultures, openly discussing death is taboo, The Chinese consider it bad luck.
I would say in my family, that's very true. We never talk about death. We don't talk about anyone being sick. We don't mention it at all.
Julie Tai's family comes from Vietnam. Her father's side of the family is ethnic Chinese. Both of her parents came to the U.S. after the war, but the rest of the family remained in Vietnam.
In our own family, we don't talk about death in definitive terms, or we don't talk about it at all because we just love our family members so much that we talk about them as though they're still alive.
Tai's family in Vietnam did not have any conversations with her 85-year-old grandfather as he was nearing death. Instead, Tai's aunt and her daughter were his medical proxies.
I think everyone just assumed that they would be in charge of his care, that they would do what they felt was right for him, but it was never talked about. And that's why his needs were not met at the end of life.
In many Asian and Latino cultures, this is the traditional way. End-of-life decisions are made by family members without including the person who's ill. Dr. Smith says he's seen it many times.
Family may want to shield their loved one, and I've dealt with this clinically. You know, don't tell mother that she has cancer.
Smith has done extensive research on racial and ethnic disparities in end-of-life care.
It's going to make her depressed. She's going to dwell on it. She can't handle it psychologically. But what we have to do, and our responsibility as providers, is talk to the loved one to see what their preference is, the person who's living with the serious illness.
But in the case of Tai's grandfather, his doctors never spoke directly with him. On the telephone, he told Tai and her mother he wanted a natural death and did not want to be resuscitated. Smith says family members often demand that everything be done to keep the patient alive.
Loyalty and respect. This is honoring your obligation to your parents to keep them alive as long as possible.
That can include invasive surgery, chemotherapy, and other aggressive and unpleasant life-sustaining treatments.
Some people may say, look, I don't want to have this aggressive treatment toward the end of my life. And I know my son will demand it. And I respect that. That's his role. And you should respect that too.
When Tai's grandfather was taken to the hospital for the last time, her aunt asked the hospital to do everything to keep him alive. But Tai says this caused him great pain and discomfort.
He was very upset. He was crying. He was pulling the IVs out. He was kind of spitting up the food. He just didn't want anything that they were giving him. He was caused more pain by them imposing these heroic measures on him as opposed to just letting him go, which is what he would have wanted.
Despite the attempts to save his life, Tai's grandfather went into cardiac arrest, and he died 24 hours later. Trained medical professionals and social workers can make a critical difference in reaching out to ethnic patients and helping them prepare for the end of life. Professional translators are needed to overcome cultural and language barriers and help facilitate conversations. But educational outreach and good communication also require special training in cultural humility, an awareness of the patient's values and traditions, and a willingness to listen closely to the patient.
You have to let the family lead instead of us coming in and saying, oh, we know all about this. We'll be right over. We'll tell you what to do.
Karen McCabe is a social worker with Hospice of Santa Cruz County. She assists dying Latino patients and their families. She says that many Latinos mistakenly equate hospice with an asylum for the mentally ill or places that hasten death. McCabe sits down with a family and describes how hospice can help them.
I often just sort of explain that we're going to be bringing nurses into your home and we're going to be sending the medicines to your house and we need somebody from your family to be in charge of care and we're going to teach them what to do and we're going to sort of set up your house like this hospital and do the best we can at your house.
One place that can help frail, low-income elders is Onlock Senior Health Services. The majority of UNLOC seniors are low-income Chinese and Latinos living in three Bay Area counties. Its comprehensive services include home visits and clinical care, meal deliveries, transportation, and adult daycare. Dr. Alana Spall is a primary care physician at UNLOC in San Francisco. Spall says conversing with participants can often be challenging, especially if cultural norms prohibit patient autonomy and discussing death.
Even though it's taboo, and I usually say, I'm your doctor and this is my job and I need to know what you want or what you don't want. And I also bring up, if we don't discuss this now, it'll put their family in a harder place later on. And that often helps because they see their family, you know, struggling to make a decision in the future and they don't want to be a burden. And so I remind them that actually telling their preferences to me is a gift that they are giving their family members.
Thanks to the efforts of Spall and other staff members, almost all of UNLOC's participants have completed advanced directives. UNLOC currently serves over 1,500 frail elders and at the end of life provides seniors with comfort care similar to hospice. Since its founding in 1971, UNLOC's innovative program has been replicated in 30 states. The goal is helping seniors age in place and live independent, active lives until the end. Julie Tai spent time at UNLOC for a student research project, and she was impressed with its results. Following the death of her grandfather, she graduated from medical school. She's now a doctor specializing in geriatrics and is trained to help seniors plan for the end of their lives.
I think I really just wanted to be a champion for the vulnerable population because I think about my grandfather and how much he meant to me. I think that made me want to care for older people even more.
Tai is hoping her parents will make their own plans for the end of life. She's asking her mother how she wants to die.
Yeah, she's pretty comfortable talking about it. She goes, just let me go.
By having open, honest conversations, Tai hopes to honor her parents' and her patients' wishes. In particular, she wants to reach out to patients bound by culture who can't talk openly about death. Efforts like Tai's could have a big impact someday on reducing racial disparities in end-of-life care. For Cross Currents, I'm Joanne Marr.
Joanne's two-part report was produced for the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism's 2018 California Fellowship. You can hear the first part of the series at kalw.org. And that's where you can hear all our stories and subscribe to the Cross Currents podcast to listen whenever and wherever you want. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Sarah Nora Coast, Angela Johnston, Kristen McCandless, Drew Gwynn, Marissa Ortega Welch, Porfirio Rangel, Josh Wilson, Lisa Wang, and Eli Wertschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer, and news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by the French Cassettes from San Francisco. They're playing at the Chapel in the city tomorrow night. Show starts at 9 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. Show no sympathy.
boys who cry and see.